Side 4. The Shining Ones. The Tomily, Book 2. By David Eddings. Continuing on page 121. He's probably right, Your Majesties, Calador agreed, foregoing the dialect. Those original documents would be an absolute gold mine. I don't know that I'd give my teeth, but I would give a lot to browse through them. Danae rolled her eyes.
Aline's,
she said under her breath. If it's all that important to you, Calador, she said, go look at them. We don't know where it is they got 'em hid, little Dorlin.
Look for them, Calador,
she said with exaggerated patience.
You've got all night, every night, for the next month or two, haven't you? Talon told me once that he can get into any house in the world in under a quarter of an hour. You two are more experienced at it, so it probably wouldn't take you nearly as long. You're not going to steal the papers. All you're going to do is read them. If you put them back where you found them after you're finished, nobody will even know that you've seen them.
Calador and Stragan looked at each other sheepishly. Why didn't we think of that? Stragan asked his friend.
It seems to me I've already told you why once,
Melodir said.
Shall we go through it again? It's really a very good idea, Princess. These two might not be much good at thinking sometimes, but they're probably very good burglars. They both have that shifty, unreliable look about them. They do just a bit, don't they?
Danae agreed.
She set Myrrh down on the floor. There, she said. Isn't she adorable?
The angry lashing of Myrrh's tail, however, totally spoiled the effect. The tail definitely detracts from the fashion statement, Danae. Sarabian laughed indulgently.
Oh, I can fix that right up, Sarabian, she assured him. I'll tell you what, Myrrh. How would you like to have me tie a big pink velvet bow right on the end of your tail to sort of set things off? You could wave it around like a parasol if you wanted.
Myrrh's tail stopped in mid-swish.
I thought you might see it that way, Danae said.
Shall we go down to the dungeon for your fencing lesson, Your Majesty?
Stragan suggested.
Calador and I are going to be busy being burglars tonight, I think.
Not only tonight, I'm afraid, Calador added. I haven't been on a roof in years.
It's like swimming, Calador, Stragan said. Once you learn how, you never forget.
I'd really like to forgo the lesson today, my lord Stragan, Sarabian said. I'm still sore from yesterday.
Fencing is not like swimming, Your Majesty, Stragan told him. You have to practice continually. If you're going to wear that rapier, you'd better know how to use it. In a tight situation, that could be your last line of defense.
Sarabian sighed.
Sometimes I wish I'd never even heard of Aline's, he mourned.
Because Aelana told me to, Myrtai said as she and Gessa, Kring, and the two thieves crossed the document-littered lawn toward the Interior Ministry. She wants to be sure that nobody interrupts you.
Myrtai, Stragan said with a pained look, I love you like a sister, but burglary's a fine art.
I think my beloved can manage, friend Stragan, Kring said. I've seen her walk through a pile of dry leaves and not make a sound.
I just don't like it, Stragan complained.
You are not required to, Stragan thief,
Angessa told him.
Aelana Queen said that Myrtai daughter will go with you, so she will go.
Myrtai smiled up at the towering Aton.
Thank you, Angessa father. It's so hard to make Aline's grasp reality sometimes.
And Gessa and I are going to relieve the two knights watching over the documents on the lawn,
Kring told them.
We'll stay fairly close to the building, and we have other men nearby. Call if anyone surprises you in there, and we'll come and rescue you.
I've never had a platoon of soldiers standing watch for me while I burglarized a building before, Calador noted. It adds a whole new dimension to the business. Stragan grunted sourly.
It takes a lot of the fun out of it. A large part of the thrill of burglary comes from the danger of getting caught.
I've never tried burglary, Kring admitted. It's not much of a challenge among the Poloi, since we all live in tents. A sharp knife will get you into the stoutest tent in the world. If we want to ransack someone's encampment, we usually send in some men to run off his horses.
He chases those men, and that gives us a free hand.
Burglary's a crime of stealth, Kring, Stragan smiled. You get to sneak around at night and climb over rooftops. It's a lot of fun, and really quite profitable.
Be careful up there on that roof, Mirtai, Kring admonished his betrothed. I went to a great deal of trouble winning you, and I'd hate to lose you at this point. Oh, speaking of that, friend Stragan, and you too, friend Kaalador, if anything happens to her, you do know that I'll kill you, don't you?
We wouldn't have it any other way, friend Kring, Stragan nodded.
Mirtai ran a caressing hand over her beloved's scalp. Stragan had noticed that she did that quite often. He wondered if the feel of the little fellow's shaved head might have had some bearing on her decision to marry him.
You need a shave, the giantess said. Remind me in the morning, and I'll take care of it.
Then Stragan, Kaalador, and Mirtai, all dressed in close-fitting black clothing, slipped through the shadows of a grove of trees near the Ministry of the Interior.
You're really fond of the little fellow, aren't you, Mirtai? Stragan murmured softly, ducking under a tree limb.
Kring, he's a suitable sort of man.
That's a rather lukewarm declaration of passion.
Passion's a private thing. It shouldn't be displayed in public.
Then you do have those feelings for him?
I don't really see where that's any of your business, Stragan.
There was a filmy layer of fog lying on the lawns of the Imperial compound. It was autumn now, and the fog crept in off the Tamil Sea every evening. The moon would not rise for hours yet, and all in all, it was a perfect night for a burglary. Kaalador was puffing when they reached the wall surrounding the Ministry of the Interior.
Out of condition, he muttered. You're almost as bad as Platymy, Stragan told him, speaking very softly.
Then he squinted upward, swinging a heavy grappling hook in his hand. He stepped back and began to whirl the hook in a wide circle, letting out more rope with each circuit. Then he hurled it upward, with the rope trailing behind it. It sailed up over the wall and fell inside, striking the stones with a metallic-sounding clink. He tugged down a couple of times to set the points in place. Then he sat down on the grass.
"Aren't we going up?" Mirtai asked him.
"Not yet. Somebody might have heard it. We'll wait until his curiosity's had time to wear off.
Filler's what's a standin' watch in the middle of the night. Ain't really all that eager to go looking for where it is as noises is a-comin' from, Dorlin," Kaalador explained.
"In my experience, they usually feel that a quiet watch is a good watch, so they don't go out of their way to investigate things. As long as nobody sets the building on fire, they're not overburdened with curiosity. Besides," he added, dipping once again into the dialect, "fellers as gits chose to stand gourd at night, usual turns out to be drankin' men, and after a flaggin or two, they can't really hear hardly nothin' at all." He looked at Stragan. "Do you want to try the ground floor before we go up on the roof?" he asked in clipped Alenic.
"No," Stragan decided. "Ground floor windows are always double-checked when people lock up, and watchmen pass the lonely hours of the night rattling door handles and trying the windows close to the ground. I've always preferred attics myself."
"What if all the attic windows are locked as well?" Mirtai asked him.
"We'll break one."
He shrugged.
"The building's high enough so that a broken window won't be all that visible from the ground."
"Don't be too obvious, Stragan," Kaalador cautioned him. "I've got the feeling that we'll be going back inside every night for the next week or two. That's a large building."
"Let's get at it, then," Stragan said, rising to his feet.
He looked out across the lawn. The fog had grown noticeably thicker. He tugged down on the rope a couple of times to make sure that the hook was secure, and then began to climb up.
"You go on up next, Dorlin," Kaalador said quietly to Mirtai.
"Why do you call me that?"
"Just a bein' friendly-like. It don't mean nothin' personal. So don't go complainin' to your bow-legged beau. He's a likable sort, but he sure is touchy where you're concerned."
"Yes," Mirtai agreed. She went quickly up the rope and joined Stragan atop the wall. "What now?" she asked.
We'll go across to the roof and start checking attic windows, just as soon as Kaalador climbs up.
You'll use the hook again?
He nodded.
Burglars are about half ape, aren't they?
We prefer to think of ourselves as agile. Now then, if we run into anybody inside, we'll try to hide first. If that doesn't work, we'll rap him on the head. Kaalador's carrying a wineskin, and he'll pour wine all over the man. The smell of that should make him less credible when he wakes up. Try not to kill anybody. It takes all night to clean up, and we'd have to carry the body away when we leave. This isn't an ordinary burglary, and we don't want anybody to know we've been here.
You're repeating the obvious, Dragan.
I've seen your instincts in operation before, love. If you do kill somebody, please try to leave most of the blood inside the body. I don't want to be caught in there with a mop in my hands when the sun comes up.
Why are you both being so affectionate tonight?
I don't think I quite followed that.
Kaalador's been calling me darling ever since we set out, and you just called me love. Is there some sort of significance to that?
He chuckled. A gang of burglars is a very close-knit group, Mirtai. We depend on each other for our very lives. That creates powerful ties of affection, which usually last right up until the point when the time comes to divide up the spoils. That's when things sometimes turn ugly.
Let's have it all in place before we make any overt moves, Sarabian, Ilana counseled. The Interior Ministry knows that we're up to something, but we're all pretending that everything's normal. The customary approach is to have everybody in custody before you start issuing proclamations and disbanding branches of government.
I can see your point, of course, he agreed.
They were standing atop the battlements again, looking out over the city as the sun rose above the thick ground fog.
That's pretty, isn't it? He observed. The color of the fog almost perfectly matches the mauve on the walls and domes.
You have a beautiful city.
With some not-so-beautiful people living in it.
What am I going to do for a police force after I dissolve the Ministry of Interior? You'll probably have to declare martial law.
He winced. The Etons won't make me very many friends, I'm afraid. They tend to have a very simplified concept of justice.
We don't have to stand for re-election, Sarabian. That's why we can do unpopular things.
Only up to a point, he disagreed. I have to live with the great houses of Tommel proper, and I'm still getting letters of protest from many of them about sons and brothers who were killed or maimed while the Etons were putting down the coup.
They were traitors, weren't they?
No, he sighed. Probably not. We Tommels pamper our children, and the noble houses carry that to extremes. Mathurian's a political city, and when young Tommels enter the university, they're expected to get involved in politics, usually of the most radical sort. The rank and position of their families protects them from the consequences of excessive juvenile enthusiasm. I was an anarchist when I was a student. I even led a few demonstrations against my father's government. He smiled faintly.
I used to get arrested on an average of once a week. They never would throw me in the dungeon, though, no matter what kind of names I called my father. I tried very hard to get thrown into the dungeon, but the police wouldn't cooperate. Why on earth did you want to spend time in a dungeon? She laughed. Young Tommel noblewomen are terribly impressed by political martyrs.
I'd have cut a wide track if I could have gotten myself in prison for a few days.
I thought you got married when you were a baby, she said. Isn't it sort of inappropriate for a married man to be thinking about how wide a track he can cut among the ladies?
My first wife and I stopped speaking to each other for about 10 years when we were young, and the fact that I was required by tradition to have 8 other wives made the notion of fidelity a sort of laughable concept.
A thought came to him. I wonder if Kaalador would consider taking a post in my government, he mused. You could do worse. I have a man named Platamy in my government, and he's an even bigger thief than Kaalador. Ilana glanced down the battlements and saw Mirtai approaching. Any luck? She asked. It's hard to say. The giantess shrugged. We got inside easily enough, but we didn't find what we were looking for. Strakin and Kaalador are going out to the university to talk with some of the scholars there.
Are they suddenly hungering and thirsting after knowledge? Sarabian asked her lightly.
"'Tain't hardly likely, Dorlin,' Mirtai replied.
"'Darling?' he asked her incredulously.
But you are, Sarabian, the golden giantess replied, gently touching his cheek. I discovered tonight that conspirators and thieves and other scoundrels are supposed to be very affectionate with each other. You're conspiring with us to overthrow the police, so you're a member of the family now. Stragan wants to talk with some specialists in architecture. He suspects that there might be some secret rooms in the Interior Ministry. He's hoping that the original plans for the building might be in some library. She gave the Emperor a sly, sidelong glance. That's what it is that they're a-doin', Dorlin, she added. Are you really sure you want Kaalador in your government, Sarabian? Elana asked him. That dialect of his seems to rub off on people. Give him a year or two, and everybody in the Imperial compound will be calling you Dorlin.
That might be preferable to some of the other names I've been called lately.
Chapter 9 Sparhawk and his friends left Siren early the next morning and rode eastward through vast golden fields of ripening wheat. The rolling countryside sloped gradually downward into the broad valley where the Pella and Edic rivers joined on the border between Edom and Seneska. Sparhawk rode in the lead, with Flute nestled in his arms. The little girl seemed unusually quiet this morning, and after they had been on the road for a couple of hours, Sparhawk leaned to one side and looked at her face. Her eyes were fixed, vacant, and her face expressionless. "What's the matter?" he asked.
"Not now, Sparhawk," she told him crossly. "I'm busy."
"Afriel, we're coming up on the border. Shouldn't we—"
"Leave me alone."
She burrowed her forehead into his chest with a discontented little sound.
"What is it, Sparhawk?"
Sophrenia asked, pulling Kyle in beside Farron.
"Afriel won't talk to me."
Sophrenia leaned forward and looked critically at Flute's face.
"Ah," she said.
"Ah, what?"
"Leave her alone, Sparhawk. She's someplace else right now."
"The border's just ahead, Sophrenia. Can we really afford to spend half a day trying to talk our way across?"
"It looks as if we'll have to. Here, give her to me."
He lifted the semi-comatose little girl and placed her in her sister's arms.
"Maybe I can move us past the border without her. I know how it's done now."
"No, Sparhawk. You're not ready to try it by yourself. We definitely don't want you to start experimenting on your own just yet. We'll have to take our chances at the border. There's no way of knowing how long Afriel's going to be busy."
"It's not anything important, is it? I mean, is Elana in any kind of danger?"
"I don't know, and I don't want to disturb Afriel just now to find out. Danae will take care of her mother. You're just going to have to trust her."
"This is very difficult, you know. How long does it take to adjust your thinking to the idea that there are three of her, and that they're all the same one?"
She gave him a puzzled look.
"Afriel, Flute, and Danae. They're all the same person, but they can be in two places at once, or even three for all I know, and doing two or three different things."
"Yes,"
she agreed.
"Doesn't that disturb you just a little?"
"Does it concern you that you're a lean god supposed to know what everybody in the world's thinking, all at the same time?"
"Well, no, I suppose not."
"What's the difference?"
"He's God, Sophrenia."
"So's she, Sparhawk."
"It doesn't seem quite the same."
"It is, though. Tell the others that we're going to have to make the border crossing on our own."
"They'll want to know why."
"Lie to them. God will forgive you. One of them will, anyway."
"You're impossible to talk to when you're like this. Do you know that?"
"Don't talk to me, then. Right now I'd prefer that you didn't, anyway."
"Is something wrong?"
"I was just a little upset when you dissolved that cloud and it started swearing at you in Styric."
"I noticed that myself." He made a face. "How could anyone have missed it? I gather it's significant."
"What language do you swear in when you stub your toe?"
"Alenic, of course."
"Of course. It's your native tongue. Doesn't that sort of suggest that Styric's the native tongue of whoever's behind that shadow?"
"I hadn't thought of that. I suppose it does."
"The fact disturbs me, Sparhawk, more than just a little bit. It suggests all sorts of things that I don't really want to accept."
"Such as?"
"There's a Styric working with our enemy, for one thing, and he's highly skilled. That shadow's the result of a very complex spell. I doubt that there are more than 8 or 10 in all of Styricum who could have managed it. And I know all of those people. They're my friends. It's not a pleasant thing to contemplate. Why don't you go bother somebody else and let me work on it?
Sparhawk gave up and dropped back to talk with the others. There's been a little change of plans, he told them. Afriel's occupied elsewhere just now, so we won't be able to avoid the border crossing.
What's she doing?
Bevier asked. You don't want to know. Believe me, Bevier, you, of all people, really don't want to know.
She's doing one of those god things? Talon guessed.
Talon,
Bevier rebuked him.
They're called miracles, not god things.
That was the word I was looking for, Talon replied, snapping his fingers.
Vanyan was frowning. Border crossings are always tedious, he told them. But the Seneskans have a reputation for carrying that to extremes. They'll negotiate the suitable bribe for days on end.
That's what axes are for, Lord Vanyan, Uloth rumbled. We use them to clear away inconveniences. Underbrush, trees, obstructionist officials, that sort of thing.
We don't need an international incident, Sir Uloth, Vanyan told him. We might be able to speed things up a bit, though. I've got an imperial pass signed by Sarabian himself. It might carry enough weight to get us past the border without too much delay.
The border between Edom and Seneska was marked by the Pella River, and at the far end of the substantial bridge there stood a solid, block-like building, with a horse corral behind it. Vanyan led them across the bridge to the barricade on the Seneskan side, where a number of armed men in strange flowing robes waited. The imperial pass Vanyan presented to the border guards not only failed to gain them immediate passage, but even added further complications.
How do I know that this is really His Majesty's signature?
The Seneskan captain demanded suspiciously, in heavily accented Tamil. He was a swarthy man, in a loose-fitting black-and-white striped robe, and with a long cloth wound intricately around his head.
What's much more to the point, neighbor, is how do you know that it isn't?
Sparhawk asked bluntly in the Tamil tongue.
The Etons take a very unpleasant stance toward people who disobey the Emperor's direct commands.
It means death to forge the Emperor's signature, the captain said ominously.
So I've been told, Vanyan replied. It also means death to ignore his orders. I'd say that one of us is in trouble.
My men still have to search your packs for contraband, the captain said haughtily. I will consider this while they carry out their orders.
Do that, Sparhawk told him in a flat, unfriendly tone of voice. And keep in mind the fact that a wrong decision here could have a negative impact on your career.
I didn't catch your meaning.
A man with no head seldom gets promoted.
I have nothing to fear, the captain declared. I am strictly following the orders of my government.
And the Etons who will chop off your head will be strictly following the orders of theirs. I'm certain that everyone involved will take enormous comfort in the fact that all the legal niceties were observed.
Sparhawk turned his back on the officious captain, and he and Vanyan walked back to rejoin the others.
Well?
Sophronia asked them.
The Emperor's voice doesn't seem to be very loud here in Seneska, Vanyan replied. Our friend in the bathrobe has a whole book full of regulations, and he's going to use every single one of them to delay us.
Did you try to bribe him?
Uloth asked.
I hinted at the fact that I might entertain a suggestion along those lines.
Vanyan shrugged.
He didn't take the hint, though. Now that's unusual, Calton noted. Bribes are always the first thing on the mind of any official anywhere in the world. That sort of suggests that he's trying to hold us here until reinforcements arrive, doesn't it?
And they're probably already on their way,
Uloth added.
Why don't we take steps?
You're just guessing, gentlemen, Sophronia chided them. You're all just itching for the chance to do Alenish things to those border guards.
Did you want to do Alenish things to people, Uloth? Calton asked mildly.
I was suggesting constructive Alenishism before we even got here.
"We're not contemplating it out of sheer bloodlust, little mother," Vanyan told the woman he loved.
"Oh, really?"
"The situation's manageable now. But if 1,000 mounted Seneskans suddenly ride in from the nearest garrison, it's going to get out of hand."
"But..."
He held up one hand. "My decision, Sophrenia. Well, Sparhawk's, actually, since he's the preceptor now."
"Interim preceptor," Sparhawk corrected.
Vanyan did not like to be corrected. "Did you want to do this?" he asked.
"No, you're doing just fine, Vanyan."
"Do you want to be quiet, then? It's a military decision, Sophrenia, so we'll have to ask you, respectfully, of course, to keep your pretty little nose out of it."
She said a very harsh word in Styric.
"I love you, too," he told her blandly. "All right, gentlemen. Let's sort of drift on over to our horses. We'll do some of those Alenish things Ulath mentioned to the men who are going through our saddlebags. Then we'll run off all those horses in that corral and be on our way."
There were a score of border guards under the captain's command. Their primary weapon seemed to be the spear, although they wore a sort of rudimentary armor and scimitars at their waists.
"Excuse me a moment, friend," Ulath said pleasantly to the fellow who was rifling his saddlebags. "I'm going to need my tools for a couple of minutes."
He reached for the war axe slung from his saddle.
"What for?"
the Seneskan demanded suspiciously in broken Tamil.
"There's something in my way."
Ulath smiled.
"I want to remove it."
He lifted his axe out of its sling, tested the edge with his thumb, and then brained the border guard with a single stroke. The fight around the horses was brief, and the outcome promised to be fairly predictable. As a group, border guards are not among the world's most highly skilled warriors.
"What do you think you're doing?"
Sparhawk bellowed at Talon, as the boy pulled his rapier out of the body of one of the Seneskans.
"Stragan's been giving me lessons," Talon replied. "I just wanted to find out if he knew what he was talking about. Watch your back."
Sparhawk spun, knocked aside the spear of a charging border guard, and cut the man down. He turned back just as Talon deftly parried the thrust of another, deflecting the curved blade off to one side. Then the young man lunged smoothly and ran the surprised fellow through.
"Neat, wouldn't you say?"
He smirked proudly.
"Quit showing off, and don't take so long to recover from your thrust. You're exposing yourself with all that posing."
"Yes, revered teacher."
What little question there had been about the outcome of the skirmish vanished once the knights were in their saddles. Things ended abruptly when the obnoxious captain, who had been shrieking,
"You're all under arrest,"
broke off suddenly, as Sir Bevier coolly swung his Lochaber axe and sent the officer's head flying.
"Throw down your weapons,"
Ulath roared at the few survivors.
"Surrender or die."
Two of the guards, however, had reached their horses. They scrambled up into their saddles and rode off to the east at a gallop. One stiffened and toppled from his saddle after about 50 yards, with Barrett's arrow protruding from between his shoulder blades. The other rode on some distance, flogging desperately at his mount. Then he, too, lurched and fell to the musical twang of Khalad's crossbow.
"Good shot," Barrett noted.
"Fair,"
Khalad agreed modestly. The rest of the Seneskans were throwing their weapons away.
"You run a good fight, Sparhawk,"
Vanyan complimented his friend.
"I had a good teacher. Colton, tie them all up and then run off their horses."
"Why me?"
"You're handy, and there's that other matter as well."
"I didn't break my oath," Colton protested.
"No, but you were thinking about it."
"What's this?" Vanyan asked.
"There's a lady involved, my lord," Sparhawk replied loftily, "and no gentleman ever discusses things like that."
"What are you doing?" Afriel asked sharply. She had raised her head from Sophrenia's shoulder and was looking suspiciously at Sparhawk.
"Are you with us again?" he asked her.
"Obviously. What are you doing?"
"There was some unpleasantness at the border, and we're probably being followed. Chased, actually."
"I can't leave you alone for a minute, can I, Father?"
"It was more or less unavoidable.
Have you finished whatever it was you were doing?
For the time being.
The town of Edek is just ahead, and we've probably got a brigade of Seneskan soldiers right behind us. Do you suppose you could move us on ahead a ways?
Why didn't you do it yourself? You know how it's done.
Sophronia wouldn't let me.
His attention wanders at critical moments, Sophronia explained. I didn't want him to put us down on the moon.
I see your point, the little girl agreed.
Why don't we just move straight on to Sinestra, Sparhawk? There's nothing between here and there but open desert, you know.
They were expecting us at the border, he replied. It seems that our friend out there has alerted everybody along the way that we're coming. There's certain to be a large garrison of troops at Sinestra, and I'd like to feel my way through the situation there before I blunder into something.
I guess that makes sense. Sort of.
How's your mother?
She's enjoying herself enormously. The political situation in Mytherian's very murky right now, and you know how much Mother loves politics.
I'm glad she's happy. You'll have to tell us about it, but let's get past Edek and outrun that Seneskan brigade first. I don't like having people snapping at my heels.
Tell the others to stop, and then get Vanyan's map. Let's be sure we know where we're going this time.
I'm never going to get used to that, Kalton shuddered after they had covered 50 leagues of open desert in a single gray-blurred moment.
Your map's not very precise, Vanyan, Afriel said critically. We were trying for a spot on the other side of that peak. She pointed at a jagged spire rearing up out of the desert.
I didn't draw the map, Vanyan replied a bit defensively. What difference does it make, though? We're close enough, aren't we? We came to within a few miles of where we wanted to go.
You'd have found out how much difference it makes if we'd been moving around near a large body of water, she said tartly. This is just too imprecise.
Vanyan looked back over his shoulder toward the west. It's almost sunset. Why don't we get back away from this road and set up for the night? If we've got a problem with this, let's find a quiet place where we can work it out. Sparhawk smiled. Despite all his protestations that he was no longer the Pandian preceptor, Vanyan automatically took charge unless he was consciously thinking about what he believed to be his changed status. Sparhawk didn't really mind. He was used to taking orders from Vanyan, and his friend's assumption of authority relieved him of the nagging details of command. They rode out into the desert a couple of miles and set up for the night in a dry wash behind an upthrust jumble of weathered boulders. Unlike the Rendorish desert, which was mostly sand, the desert here in Seneska was sun-baked gravel, rusty brown and sterile. The moving sands of Rendor at least gave an illusion of life. Seneska was dead. Stark, treeless peaks clawed harshly at the sky, and the vast emptiness of gravel and rock was broken only by flat, bleached white beds of alkali.
Ugly place, Uloth grunted, looking around.
Uloth was used to trees and snow-capped peaks. I'm sorry you feel that way. Kalton grinned. I was thinking of selling it to you.
You couldn't give it to me.
Look on the bright side. It almost never rains here.
I think that's part of the problem.
There's a lot of wild game, though.
Really?
Snakes, lizards, scorpions, that sort of thing.
Have you developed a taste for baked scorpion?
No, I don't think so.
I wouldn't waste any arrows on them, then.
Speaking of eating...
Were we speaking of that?
It's a topic that comes up from time to time. Do you know of a way to set fire to rocks?
Not right offhand, no.
Then I'll volunteer to fix supper. I haven't seen a stick or a twig or even a dry leaf around here, so a fire's sort of out of the question. Oh, well, cold food never hurt anybody.
We can get by without fire, Vanyan said, but we're going to have water for the horses.
Afriel and I can manage that, dear, Sophronia assured him.
Good. I think we might be here for a day or so. Sparhawk and Afriel are going to be working with Belium on this little problem of precision.
He looked inquiringly at the child goddess.
Is it likely to take very long? He asked her.
I'm not really positive, Vanyan. When I do it, I still have the surrounding terrain to refer to, so I know where I am, no matter how fast I'm going. Bellium goes from one place to another instantaneously, without any reference points. It's an altogether different process. Either Sparhawk and I are going to have to learn how Bellium's technique works, or we're going to have to make Bellium understand exactly what we want.
Which way would be easier? Colton asked her.
I'm not sure. It's possible that they're about the same. Both very, very difficult. We'll find out tomorrow morning.
She looked at Vanyan.
Are we more or less safe where we are right now?
Vanyan scratched at his short, silvery beard.
Nobody really expects us to be here. Somebody might accidentally stumble across us, but there won't be any kind of organized search. They don't know where we are, and the rings are shielded, so our friend out there won't be able to pick up the sense of their location and follow that to us. I'd say that we're safe here.
Good. We've got some time, then. Let's use it to let Sparhawk and Bellium get to know each other. There's nothing all that crucial going on right now, so a few mistakes and false starts won't hurt anything. They might be disastrous later on, though.
Sophronia did not tell them where the water came from the next morning, but it was icy cold and tasted of snowmelt. It sparkled invitingly in its shaded little pool behind a rust-colored boulder, and by its very presence it alleviated a great deal of tension. Water is a source of major concern to people in a desert. Flute took Sparhawk, Khalad, and Talon some distance out onto a broad graveled plain to begin the instruction.
It's going to get hot out here before long, Talon complained.
Probably yes, the little girl agreed.
Why do Khalad and I have to come along?
Vanyan needs the knights with him here in case someone stumbles across our camp.
You missed my point. Why do you two need anybody to come along?
Sparhawk has to have people and horses to carry. He's not going to be moving sacks of grain from place to place, you know.
She looked at Vanyan's map.
Let's see if Bellium can take us to this oasis up here, Sparhawk, she said, pointing at a symbol on the map.
What does it look like? He asked her.
How would I know? I've never been there either.
All you're giving me to work with is a name, Afriel. Why don't we do it the way we did when we moved from outside Jorsen up to Korvan, and all those other places we went to when we were jumping around to confuse the other side? You tell Bellium where we want to go, and then I'll tell it to do it.
We can't be sure that I'll always be available, Sparhawk. There are times when I have to be away. The whole idea here is to train you and Bellium to work together without my intervention.
A name isn't really very much to take hold of, you know.
There'll be trees, Sparhawk, Khalad told him. An oasis is kind of a pond, and anywhere you've got water, you're going to have trees.
And probably houses, Talon added. There'd almost have to be houses, since water's so scarce here in Seneska.
Let's see the map, Sparhawk said.
He studied the chart carefully for quite some time.
All right, he said finally. Let's try it and see what happens.
He lifted the cap on his ring and touched the band to the lid of the golden box.
Open, he said.
Then he put on the other ring and took out the Bellium.
It's me again, he told the jewel.
Oh, that's absurd, Sparhawk, Afriel told him.
Formal introductions take too long, he replied. There may come a time when I'll be in a hurry.
He carefully imagined a desert oasis, an artesian-fed pond with its surrounding palms and flat-roofed white houses.
Take us there, Blue Rose, he commanded.
The air blurred and faded into gray. Then the blur cleared, and the oasis was there, just as he had imagined it.
You see, Sparhawk? Afriel said smugly. That wasn't hard at all, was it?
Sparhawk even laughed out loud. This might work out after all.
Talon, Khalad said, why don't you ride on down to one of those houses and ask somebody the name of this place?
It's Jubé, Khalad, Flute told him. That's where we wanted to go, so that's where we are.
You wouldn't mind a bit of verification, would you?
He asked her innocently. She scowled at him. Talon rode down to the cluster of houses and returned a few minutes later.
Let me see the map, he said to Khalad.
Why? Flute asked him.
We're in Jubé, up near the Etan border.
No, Divine One, the boy disagreed.
Actually, we're not. He studied the map for several minutes.
Ah, he said, here it is.
He pointed. This is where we're at. Vagayo, down near the southern border, where Seneca adjoins Arjuna. You missed your mark by about 300 leagues, Sparhawk. I think you'd better sharpen your aim just a bit.
What were you thinking about? Afriel demanded.
Pretty much what Khalad was talking about. Trees, a pond, white houses. Just exactly what there is in front of us.
Now what? Talon asked. Do we go back to where we started and try again? Afriel shook her head.
Belium and the rings are unshielded. We don't want to put Vanyan, Sophrenia, and the others in danger by going back there too often. Let me down, Sparhawk. I want to think about this.
He set her down on the ground, and she walked down to the edge of the oasis, where she stood throwing pebbles into the water for a while. Her expression was dubious when she returned. Sparhawk lifted her again.
Well? He asked.
Take us to Jubé, Sparhawk, she said firmly.
Let me see the map again, Khalad.
No, Afriel said very firmly. Never mind the map. Just tell Belium to take us to Jubé.
Exactly, Khalad said, snapping his fingers.
Why didn't we think of that before?
Think of what? Sparhawk demanded.
Try it, my lord,
Khalad grinned.
I think you might be surprised.
If we wind up on the moon, you two are in trouble, Sparhawk threatened.
Just try it, Sparhawk, Flute told him.
Blue Rose, take us to Jubé. He said it without much conviction.
The air blurred again, and when it cleared, they were sitting on their horses beside another oasis. There were a number of significant differences between this one and the one they just left.
There probably isn't any need, Khalid said to his brother. But you might want to ask anyway, just to be sure.
Talon rode on around the oasis and spoke with an old woman who had just come out of one of the houses. He was grinning when he came back.
Jubé, he told them. How could it find the place with only the name to work with? Sparhawk demanded. It's probably never even heard the name Jubé before.
But the people who live here have, my lord.
Khalad shrugged.
The name Jubé was sort of floating around in their minds. That's all Belium really needed to find the place. Isn't that more or less the way it works, Flute?
That's exactly how it works. All Sparhawk has to do is mention the name of the place he wants to visit. Belium will find it and take us there.
Are you sure?
Talon sounded uncertain about the whole notion.
It seems awfully simple to me.
There's one way to find out. Take us to Akan, Sparhawk.
Where is it? What kingdom, I mean?
I don't think you need to know that. Just take us there.
Akan was a town in the mountains. Some mountains, somewhere. It was surrounded by dark green fir trees, and the nearby peaks were snow-capped.
Better and better, Flute said happily.
Where are we? Talon asked, looking around.
This isn't Seneca, that's for certain. So where is it?
What difference does it make? Flute shrugged. Torelta, Sparhawk.
It was snowing in Torelta. The wind came howling in off a lead-gray sea, driving a blizzard before it. The buildings around them were dim and indistinct in the swirling snowstorm, but they seemed to be constructed of rough-hewn logs.
There's no limit, Flute exclaimed. We can go anywhere.
All right, Sparhawk said very firmly. Just which anywhere have we come to?
It doesn't matter. Let's go back to where we started from.
Of course, he agreed pleasantly. Just as soon as you tell us where we are.
I'm getting cold, Sparhawk. I'm not dressed for a blizzard.
It's nice and warm back in Seneca, he told her. And we'll go there. Just as soon as you tell me where we are.
She said a naughty word.
Torelta's on the north coast of Astel, Sparhawk. It's almost winter here now.
He looked around with feigned surprise.
Why, I believe you're right. Isn't that amazing?
He visualized the flat gravel plain near the dry wash where they had set up camp the previous evening. He groped for a name for a moment, then remembered the blunder he had made when they had first set out.
Hold the box open, Khalad, he instructed. I'll put Belium and Elana's ring inside just as soon as we get back.
He drew the picture in his mind again.
Take us there, Blue Rose, he commanded.
Where have you been? Sophronia demanded. She and Vanyan had ridden out onto the gravel plain to look for them.
Oh, Talon said evasively, brushing the snow off his shoulders. Here and there. I gather that one of the places was quite a ways off, Vanyan surmised, looking at the snow still clinging to the travelers.
It's really amazing, Sophronia, Flute said happily. And it's all so simple.
Halag closed the box and handed it to Sparhawk. Sparhawk snapped the cap down over the ruby on his ring, and then put the box back inside his tunic. We made a couple of false starts right at first, though, he admitted. How does it work? Vanyan asked. We just let Belium take care of everything. Sparhawk shrugged. We have to do it that way, actually. It's when we try to help that things go wrong.
Could you be just a bit more specific than that? Sophronia asked Flute. Sparhawk's really very close. All he has to do is tell Belium a name, any name, of any place at all. Belium goes and finds it, and then it takes us there.
That's all?
That's it, dear sister. Not even Sparhawk can make any mistakes this way.
Chapter 10
We have to pick up someone there, that's why, Flute told them.
Who? Carlton asked.
I don't know. All I know is that someone's supposed to go with us, and we have to pick him up in Sinestra.
Another one of those hunches of yours?
You can call it that if you want to.
I don't think we'll want to go into the city itself until we've had a chance to feel things out, Vanyan said, looking up from his map. There's a village just to the west of town. Let's go there and nose around a bit. What's the name? Sparhawk asked him, opening the box and taking out his wife's ring. Narset, Vanyan replied, looking up from the map. All right.
Sparhawk took out the Belium. He held it up and frowned slightly.
May I borrow your handkerchief, little mother? He asked Sophronia.
Use your own, she told him.
I seem to have left home without one. I'm not going to blow my nose on it, Sophronia. Belium's getting dusty. I wanted to brush it off a bit.
She gave him a peculiar look.
It's being very helpful. I don't want it to think that I'm ungrateful.
Why should you care what it thinks?
She's obviously never commanded troops, Sparhawk said to Vanyan. You might want to expose her to the notion of two-way loyalty someday. If I get around to it. Do you suppose we can go to Narset as soon as you've finished with your housekeeping?
Sparhawk brushed off the glowing petals of the sapphire rose.
How's that? He asked it. I think he's losing his grip on his sanity, Carlton said to Uloth. Not really, Sparhawk disagreed. It's got an awareness, almost a personality. I could use the rings like whips and drive it, I suppose, but I think I'd prefer willing cooperation. The time may come when that's important.
He gave Sophronia back her handkerchief.
Ready with a box, Halad, he told his squire.
He looked at Vanyan again.
Narset? He asked.
Narset, Vanyan replied firmly.
Blue Rose, Sparhawk said, taking the jewel in both hands. Let's go to Narset.
The Belium throbbed, and that blurred twilight came down briefly. Then it cleared again. Narset was a small, dusty village. The houses were hardly more than mud huts, and they had flat roofs and animal pens at the rear. Pens that seemed largely decorative, since chickens, pigs, and goats wandered freely in the streets. There was a fair-sized city lying to the east, and all the buildings in that city were covered with white plaster to ward off the brutal desert sun. Sparhawk put Belium and Aelana's ring away, and flipped the golden cap back down over his own ring.
We've got company coming, Talon warned.
A sallow-faced Tommel, in a green silk robe, was approaching with a squad of Senescan soldiers. Swarthy men, in the same flowing black and white robes and intricately wound cloth headdresses as the guards at the border had worn. The Tommel had hard-looking eyes, which he tried to conceal behind a contrived expression of joviality.
Well met, Sir Knights.
He greeted them in slightly accented Alenic.
We've been expecting you. I am Khanzad,
chief of the local office of the Ministry of the Interior. Ambassador Traubel posted me here to greet you.
His Excellency is too kind, Vanyan murmured.
All the officials of the Empire have been instructed to cooperate with you fully, Lord
Vanyan.
Khanzad covered a momentary confusion. I was led to believe that a Sir Sparhawk would be in command of your party.
Sparhawk's been detained. He'll be joining us later.
Ah, Khanzad recovered. I'm afraid there'll be some slight delay before you can enter the city, Lord Vanyan.
Oh?
Khanzad smiled a thin, humorless smile. King Jalua is feeling neglected at the moment. He threw a quick look at the squad of Seneskans standing several paces behind him, then lowered his voice to a confidential tone. Frankly, Lord Vanyan, the Seneskans and this pest-hole they call home are so unimportant in the affairs of the Empire that no one takes them seriously. They're terribly touchy about that. Some idiot at the embassy neglected to pass on a routine communication from Mithurian, and now the king's sulking in his palace. His sycophants have filled the street with crowds of demonstrators. Ambassador Taubel's trying to smooth things over without resorting to the use of the Aton garrison, but things are a bit strained in the streets of Sinestra just now. His Excellency suggests that you and your companions wait here in Narset until he sends word that it's safe for you to proceed.
As you think best, Vanyan murmured politely.
Khanzad visibly relaxed. First of all, let's get in out of this accursed sun. He turned and led them into the shabby village. There were no more than a couple dozen of the mud huts surrounding a well located in the sun-baked central square. Sparhawk idly wondered if the women of the village went to the well in the first steely light of dawn, as the women of Cypria in Rendor had, and if they could possibly move with the same fluid grace. Then, for no reason at all, he wondered how Lilius was doing. Afriel leaned toward him from her sister's horse.
"Shame on you, Sparhawk," she murmured.
"You've met Lilius," he replied easily. "So you know that she's not the sort of woman you forget, no matter how much you might want to." The only building of any substance in the village was the local police station, an ominous stone structure with black iron bars on the windows. Khanzad's expression was smoothly apologetic. "It's not very inviting, Lord Vanyan," he said deprecatingly, "but it's the coolest place in this pigsty."
"Should we kill him now and get it over with?"
Bevier murmured to Sparhawk in Styric. "Let's hold off on that," Sparhawk replied. "We have to wait for Afriel's friend, whoever he is, so let's not precipitate anything just yet." "I've had some refreshments prepared," Khanzad said to Vanyan. "Why don't we go inside? That sun is really growing unbearable."
The knights dismounted and followed the policeman into the large, dusty office. There was a long table set against one wall, a table laden with plates of sliced melon and figs, and with flagons that promised other refreshments.
"The fruits and melons here aren't nearly as palatable as those you'd find in Mithurian," Khanzad apologized, "but the local wines aren't entirely undrinkable."
"Thanks all the same, Khanzad," Vanyan declined, "but we stopped for lunch no more than an hour ago. We're all just fine."
A momentary flicker of annoyance crossed the Tamil's face.
"I'll go make sure that your horses are being properly cared for then, and I'll send a messenger to the embassy to advise Ambassador Taubel of your arrival."
He turned and went out.
"Could you arrange some privacy, dear?" Vanyan asked Sophronia in Styric.
"Of course."
She smiled. She quickly wove the spell and released it.
"Someday you'll have to teach me that one," he said.
"And become redundant?"
She smiled.
"Not on your life, my love."
"We appear to have taken them by surprise," Bevier noted. "Khanzad doesn't seem to have had much time to knock the rough edges off those lies he told us."
"I wouldn't," Ulof said, as Colton reached for one of the wine flagons. "One sip of that would probably stiffen you like a plank."
Colton regretfully pushed the flagon away.
"I suppose you're right," he agreed.
"We're prisoners then, aren't we?" Talon sighed. "That's depressing. I've been a thief all my life,
and this is the first time I've ever been arrested.
The fact that these refreshments are probably poisoned complicates things just a bit,
Uloth growled.
Aside from that, Khanzad's been very helpful. He's just put us inside the strongest building in the village, and he rather carelessly forgot to take our weapons. We can hold this place for as long as necessary.
You're a fraud, Uloth, Bevier laughed. Tinian's right. You pretend to hate sieges, but you're always the first one to suggest forting up.
A true friend wouldn't mention that.
I can provide water if worst comes to worst, Sophronia told them, but let's not precipitate anything just yet. She reached down and picked Flute up. Have you had any hints about the one we're waiting for yet? Flute shook her head. Nothing very specific so far. I think he's on his way, though. Good. This isn't really a very pleasant place. A thought, my lords, Barrett said. Wouldn't it be a good idea to have Khanzad in here with us? Just as a precaution? If someone starts thinking about storming the building, that might make them give it a few second thoughts.
Good point, Uloth agreed.
Khanzad, however, did not return. The afternoon inched along, and the knights grew increasingly restless.
He's stalling, you know, Carlton said finally. Either he's got reinforcements on the way, or he's hoping that we'll get thirsty.
We'll just have to wait, Carlton, Flute told him. The one who's going to be joining us is on his way.
It's a race, then. We get to sit here making wagers on who gets here first, our new traveling companion, or Khanzad's reinforcements.
You can look at it that way if you want to, I suppose. It was about 2 hours after their arrival in Narset, when a large party came along the road from Sinestra. The man in the lead wore a rose-colored tamal robe, and he was riding a spirited black horse. The ones following him were Etons.
"Whose side are the Etons on?" Talon asked.
"That depends on whether or not word from Matherian has reached the local garrison, telling them to ignore orders from the Ministry of the Interior," Khalad replied.
"Things could be even murkier than that," Vanyan suggested. "Back in Matherian, there's no love lost between the Foreign Ministry and Interior. Khanzad was hinting at the fact that he and Ambassador Taubel are very cozy."
"That might suggest that our enemies have managed to penetrate Oscania's service," Bevier added, with a slightly worried frown. "We'll find out in a minute," Barrett said from where he had been watching out the window. "Khanzad just came out from behind the building." They all crowded around the windows to watch. Khanzad's welcoming smile crumbled from his face.
"What are you doing here, Itanya?" he demanded of the Tamil on the black horse. "I sent for Ambassador Taubel."
The rose-clad man reined in. His eyes looked almost sleepy, and he had a lofty, superior expression on his face.
"I'm afraid the ambassador's been detained, old boy," he replied in a cultured, almost deliberately insulting tone.
His voice was oddly familiar.
"He sends you his very best, though."
Khanzad struggled to regain his composure.
"What is it exactly that's delaying the ambassador?" he asked bluntly.
Itanya turned his head slightly.
"I'd say it was the chains, wouldn't you, Etana?"
he asked the young Etan woman, who appeared to be in charge of the detachment.
"It's deucedly hard to run with chains on."
"It could be the chains, Itanya ambassador," the girl agreed. "Of course, the bars of his cell might be getting in his way, too." The young woman was full-figured, and her eyes were bold as she looked at the Tamil official.
"What's going on here?" Khanzad demanded.
"The Etana and I have become very close friends since my arrival, Khanzad," Itanya smiled. "But gentlemen shouldn't really talk about that sort of thing, should they? You are a gentleman, aren't you, Khanzad?"
"I wasn't talking about that."
Khanzad's teeth were clenched.
"What have you done with the ambassador?"
"There have been a few changes at the embassy, old boy, and in your own offices as well. I really hope you don't mind, but I had to commandeer your building. We don't have a dungeon at the embassy. Distressing oversight there, I suppose. Anyway, Ambassador Taubel,
along with all your grubby little policemen, are presently locked safely away in your dungeon. My compliments on it, incidentally. It's really very nice. By whose authority have you imprisoned the ambassador? You're only an undersecretary. Appearances can be deceiving, can't they? Actually, my brother placed me in charge here in Sinestra. My authority is absolute.
Your brother?
Didn't the similarity between Oscania's name and mine set off any bells in your brain, old boy? I knew you fellows at Interior were sort of limited, but I didn't think you were that dense. Shall we cut directly on through to the significant part of this discussion, Khanzad? It's beastly hot out here in the sun. My brother's authorized me to take charge here. I have the full support and cooperation of the Aton garrison, don't I, Aitana? He smiled at the golden giantess standing beside his horse.
Oh, my. Yes, Aitanya.
She rolled her eyes.
We'll do almost anything for you.
There you have it, then, Khanzad, Aitanya said. I've uncovered the fact that you and Taubel are a part of a treasonous conspiracy, so I've removed you from authority. I have all these lovely muscles to back me up, so there's really not a blasted thing you can do about it, is there?
You have no authority over me, Aitanya.
How tiresome. Aitanya sighed. Sinestra's currently under martial law, Khanzad. That means that I have authority over everybody. The Aitons control the streets. I know you share my confidence in them. He looked critically at the policeman's stubborn face. You just don't understand at all, do you, old boy? He smiled fondly at the giantess. Aitana, dear, what would you do if I asked you to delete this tiresome wretch?
I'd kill him, Aitanya.
She shrugged, reaching for her sword.
Did you want me to split him up the middle, or just cut off his head?
Charming girl, Aitanya murmured. Let me think about it for a while, Aitana. Khanzad's a fairly high-ranking official, so there may be some formalities involved. He turned back to the now pasty-faced policeman. I'm sure you see how things stand, dear boy, he said. Oh, I suppose you should sort of consider yourself under arrest.
On what charge?
I'm a foreign serviceman, Khanzad, so I'm not really up on all these legal terms. I suppose high treason will have to do. That's the crime they arrested Interior Minister Kolata for, anyway, and I used it again when I had Taubel picked up. It's an impressive sort of charge, and I'm sure that a man of your standing would be insulted if I had you arrested for loitering or spitting in the street. Aitana, love, do be a dear and have this criminal taken back to Sinestra and thrown in his own dungeon?
At once, Aitanya Ambassador, she replied.
Darling child, he murmured.
You favor your brother, Your Excellency, Vanyan said to the smiling Aitanya, not only in physical appearance, but also in temperament. How is the old rascal? He was well the last time we saw him, Vanyan frowned. It might have been helpful if he'd told us that he was sending you here, though.
That's my brother for you. Sometimes I think he tries to keep secrets from himself.
Exactly what happened here, Your Excellency? Sparhawk asked him.
You would be Sir Sparhawk, Aitanya guessed.
Your nose is really famous, you know.
Thank you, Kalton said modestly.
Aitanya looked puzzled.
I broke it for him, Your Excellency, when we were children. I knew it was a good idea when I did it. He wears it like a badge. I'm a little disappointed in the fact that he's never once considered thanking me for the service I did him.
Aitanya smiled. As you've probably gathered, gentlemen, Oscania sent me to Sinestra to look into the rather peculiar situation here. The chain of command in the outer corners of the Empire has always been a little cloudy. The Foreign Office takes the position that the Aline Kingdoms of the West, as well as Valesia, Arjuna, and Sinesca, are essentially foreign nations subservient to Tamil proper. This would make the ambassadors to those kingdoms the ultimate authority. Interior has always maintained that those kingdoms are integral parts of metropolitan Tamale, and that puts them in charge. Oscania and Kolata have been quibbling about it for years now. Ambassador Taubel's a political hack, and his stunning ability to reach a working accommodation with Interior sort of surprised my brother. That's why he pulled me out of the university
where I was quite happily putting down roots, and sent me here to investigate, in the guise of an undersecretary. He laughed. I'll make sure that he regrets it as much this time as he did both other times.
That one escaped me, I'm afraid, Sparhawk conceded.
This is the third time Oscania's wrenched me out of private life to put out fires for him. I don't really like being wrenched, so I think I'll teach him a lesson this time. Maybe if I replace him as foreign minister for a while, he'll get the point, if I ever decide to let him have his office back again.
Are you really that good, Itania?
Sophronia asked him. Oh, good God, yes, dear lady. I'm at least twice as good as Oscania, and he knows it. That's why my appointments are always temporary. Where was I? Oh, yes. I came to Sinestra, set up a functional apparatus, and found out in fairly short order that Taubel and Khanzad were eating from the same plate. Then I intercepted the instructions Mathurian sent to Taubel after the disturbances there. I decided not to trouble him with the distressing news, so I went to the Etan garrison and personally took care of advising our towering friends that the Ministry of the Interior was no longer relevant. They were quite pleased about it, actually. The Etans dislike policemen intensely for some reason. I think it has to do with their national character. I was about ready to move on Khanzad and Taubel when one of my spies brought me word of your impending arrival. So I decided to wait until you got here, before I upended things. I must say, Sparhawk, you really upset the people in the local office of the Interior Ministry.
Oh?
They were running through the hall screaming, Sparhawk is coming! Sparhawk is coming! He has that effect on people sometimes, Flute told him. She looked around at the others. This is the one, she told them. We can leave here now.
Itania looked baffled. In a moment, Sophronia said to her sister. Itania, how did Interior find out that we were coming?
He shrugged. I didn't really look into that too deeply. There are all sorts of disgusting people who work for the Interior Ministry. One of them probably flogged 4 or 5 horses to death to bring the news.
Quite impossible, she said. No one could have gotten here ahead of us by normal means. Could the news have been brought by a styric?
There aren't any styrics in Sinesca, dear lady. The hatred between Sinescans and styrics predates history.
Yes, I know. I think you may be wrong, though. I'm almost positive that at least one styric passed through Sinestra just before the people at Interior went into their panic.
How did you arrive at that conclusion, little mother?
Venion asked her.
There's a styric working with our enemies, she replied. He was in that shadow Sparhawk dissolved back in Edom. Whoever was inside was screaming in styric at any rate. She frowned. I still don't understand how he got here before we did, though. He might be a renegade of some kind, who has dealings with the elder gods. We've never really understood the full extent of their power.
Could it be an elder god himself? Bevier asked apprehensively. No. Flute said flatly. We imprisoned them all when we overthrew them, in much the same way we imprisoned Azash. The elder gods don't move around.
I seem to be missing about half of this conversation, Itania observed. Aren't some introductions in order at this point?
Sorry, Your Excellency, Vanyan apologized. We weren't really trying to be mysterious. The lady is obviously styric. May I present Sophronia, High Priestess of the Goddess Afriel.
The Child Goddess?
You know of her?
Sophronia asked him.
Some of my styric colleagues at the university mentioned her to me. They didn't really seem to approve of her. They evidently feel that she's flighty, and a little frivolous.
Flighty? Flute objected.
Frivolous?
Don't take it personally, Sparhawk told her.
But it is personal, Sparhawk. They've insulted me.
When you get back to Mathurian, I want you to go to the university and issue a challenge to those impious wretches.
I want blood, Sparhawk. Blood.
Human sacrifice, Divine One? He asked mildly. Isn't that a little out of character?
Well,
she hesitated.
Couldn't you spank them anyway?
Itania was staring at them.
Disappointing, isn't it?
Talon murmured.
To say that Oscania's brother was shaken would be a profound understatement. He kept staring at Flute with bulging eyes as they rode eastward from Sinestra.
Oh, do stop that, Itania, she told him.
I'm not going to sprout another head or turn into a gorgon. He shuddered and passed one hand across his face. I should probably tell you that I don't believe in you, he said. I'm not trying to be offensive, mind. It's just that I'm a confirmed skeptic in religious matters. I'll bet I can change your mind, she suggested with an impish little smile. Stop that, Sophronia told her. He's a self-confessed agnostic, Sophronia. That makes him fair game. Besides, I like him. I've never had a Tamil worshipper before, and I think I want one. Itania will do just fine. No. I didn't ask you to buy him for me, Sophronia. I'll coax him out of the bushes all by myself, so you're not in any way involved. It's really none of your business, dear sister, so keep your nose out of it.
Does this ever get any easier? Itania plaintively asked the rest of them.
No, Carlton laughed. You get numb after a while, though. I've found that drinking helps.
That's Carlton's answer to everything, Foot said with an airy little toss of her head. He tries to cure winter with a barrel of Archean Red. Every year.
Have we finished here in this part of the Empire? Sparhawk asked her.
No, something else is supposed to happen. The child got aside and nestled against her sister. Please don't be angry with me, Sophronia, she said. You're not going to like what's coming, I'm afraid. It's necessary, though. No matter how much it upsets you, always remember that I love you. She sat up and held her hands out to Sparhawk. I need to talk with you, she said to him. Privately.
Secrets? Talon asked her.
Every girl needs secrets, Talon. You'll learn more about that as time goes on. Let's ride off a ways, Sparhawk.
They rode away from the road for several hundred yards, and then moved on, keeping pace with the others. Farron's steel-shod hooves clattered on the rusty, sun-baked gravel of the desert floor.
We'll be going on toward the Tamil border, Flute said as they rode. This event that's ahead of us will happen there, and I'll have to leave you before it does.
Leave? He was startled.
You'll be able to manage without me for a while. I can't be present when this event takes place. There's a propriety involved. I may be as flighty and frivolous as Itania suggested, but I do have good manners. A certain personage will be taking part in this affair, and he'd be insulted if I were present. He and I have had some disagreements in the past, and we're not speaking to each other at the moment.
She made a rueful little face.
It's been quite a lengthy moment, she admitted. 8 or 10,000 years, actually. He's doing something I don't really approve of. Of course, he's never fully explained it to me. I like him well enough, but he's got a terribly superior attitude. He always behaves as if the rest of us are too stupid to understand what he's doing. But I understand very well. He's breaking one of the cardinal rules.
She waved her hand as if brushing it aside.
That's between him and me, though. Look after my sister, Sparhawk. She's going to have a very difficult time.
She's not going to get sick, is she?
She'd probably prefer that.
The child got aside.
I wish there was some way I could spare her this, but there isn't. She has to go through it if she's going to continue to grow.
Afriel, she's over 300 years old.
What's that got to do with it? I'm 100 times older than that, and I'm still growing. She has to do the same. I'm lovable, Sparhawk, but I never promised to be easy. This is going to be terribly painful to her, but she'll be much better for having gone through it.
You're not making any sense, you know.
I don't have to make sense, Father. That's one of the advantages of my situation.
They made the journey from Sinestra to the border west of Sarna in easy stages, moving at a leisurely pace from oasis to oasis. Sparhawk could not be positive, but it seemed Afriel was waiting for something. She and Vanyan spent a great deal of time with the map, and their jumps across the sun-baked gravel of eastern Sinesca grew shorter and shorter, and their stays at the oases longer. As they neared the border, their pace slowed even more, and more often than not they found themselves simply riding, plodding their way eastward through the interminable, empty miles, without any resort to Belium at all.
It's difficult to get anything very precise, Itania was saying on the afternoon of their fourth day out from Sinestra. Most of the sightings have been made by desert nomads, and they don't trust the authorities enough to speak with them at any length. There have been the usual wild stories about vampires and werewolves and harpies and the like,
but I rather imagine that most of those flew out of the neck of a wineskin. The Senescan authorities laugh most of those off as no more than the hallucinations of ignorant people who drink too much and spend too much time out in the sun. They take the reports of sightings of the Shining Ones very seriously, however.
All righty, Tanya, Calton said irritably. We've been hearing about these Shining Ones ever since we came to Deresia. People turn all trembly and white-knuckled and refuse to talk about them. We've got you way out here in the desert where you can't run away. So why don't you tell us just who, or what, they are?
It's really quite grotesque, Sir Calton, Itanya told him, and more than a little sickening.
I've got a strong stomach. Are they some kind of monster, 12 feet tall and with 9 heads or something?
No. Actually, they're supposed to look like ordinary humans.
Why are they called by that peculiar name? Barrett asked.
Why don't you let me ask the questions, Barrett? Calton said bluntly.
Calton, it appeared, still had problems where Barrett was concerned.
Excuse me, Sir Calton, Barrett replied, looking just a bit startled and slightly hurt.
Well, Calton said to Oscania's brother, what does it mean? Why are they called that?
Because they glow like fireflies, Sir Calton.
Itanya shrugged. That's all? Calton asked incredulously. The whole continent collapses in terror just because some people glow in the dark?
Of course not. The fact that they glow is just a warning. Everybody in Tamale knows that when he sees someone who shines like the morning star coming toward him, he'd better turn around and run for his life.
What are these monsters supposed to be able to do? Talon asked. Do they eat people alive, or tear them all to pieces or something?
No, Itanya replied somberly. The legend has it that their merest touch is death.
Sort of like poisonous snakes? Khalad suggested.
Much worse than that, young sir. The touch of the Shining Ones rots a man's flesh from his bones. It's the decay of the grave, and the victim isn't dead when it happens. The descriptions from folklore are very lurid. We are given pictures of people standing stock still, shrieking in agony and horror, as their faces and limbs dissolve into slime and run like melted wax.
That's a graphic picture, Uloth shuddered. I'd imagine it sort of interferes with establishing normal relations with these people.
Indeed, Sir Uloth. Itanya smiled. But despite all of that, the Shining Ones are among the most popular figures in Tamil literature, which may provide you with some insight into the perversity of our minds.
Are you talking about ghost stories? Talon asked him. Some people like those, I've heard.
Delphaic literature is far more complex than that.
Delphaic?
What does that mean? Literature refers to the Shining Ones as the Delphae, Itanya replied. And the mythic city where they live is called Delphaeus.
It's a pretty name.
I think that's part of the problem. Tamils tend to be sentimentalists, and the musical quality of the word fills the eyes of our lesser poets with tears, and their brains with mush. They ignore the most unpleasant aspects of the legend, and present the Delphae as a simple pastoral people who are grossly misunderstood. For 7 centuries they've inflicted abominable pastoral verse and overdrawn adolescent eclogues on us. They've pictured the Delphae as lyric shepherds, glowing like fireflies and mooning about the landscape, suffering pangs of unrequited love, and pondering, ponderously, of course, the banalities of their supposed religion. The academic world has come to regard Delphaic literature as a bad joke, perpetuated far too long.
It's an abomination, Sophronia declared with uncharacteristic heat.
Your critical perception does you credit, dear lady, Itanya smiled. But I think your choice of terms over-dignifies the genre. I'd characterize Delphaic literature as adolescent sentimentality, perhaps, but I don't really take it seriously enough to grow indignant about it.
Delphaic literature is a mask for the most pernicious kind of anti-steric bigotry, she said in tones she usually reserved for ultimatums.
Vanyan appeared to be as baffled by her sudden outburst as Sparhawk and the rest. He looked around, obviously seeking some way to change the subject. "It's moving on toward sunset," Colton noted, stepping in to lend a hand. Colton's perceptiveness sometimes surprised Sparhawk.
"Flute," he said, "did you plan to put us down beside another one of those water holes for the night?"
"Oasis, Colton," Vanyan corrected him. "They call it an oasis, not a water hole."
"That's up to them. They can call it whatever they want. But I know a water hole when I see one. If we're going to do this the old-fashioned way, we're going to have to start looking for a place to camp. And there's a ruin of some kind on that hilltop over there to the north. Sophrenia can squeeze water out of the air for us. And if we stay in those ruins, we won't have to put up with the smell of boiling dog all night, the way we usually do when we camp near one of their villages."
"The Seneskan don't eat dogs, Sir Colton,"
Itanya laughed.
"I wouldn't swear to that without an honest count of all the dogs in one of their villages, both before and after supper."
"Sparhawk!"
It was Halot, and he was roughly shaking his lord into wakefulness.
"There are people out there."
Sparhawk threw his blankets to one side and rolled to his feet, reaching for his sword.
"How many?" he asked quietly.
"I've seen a dozen or so. They're creeping around among those boulders down by the road."
"Wake the others."
"Yes, my lord."
"Quietly, Halot."
Halot gave him a flat, unfriendly stare.
"Sorry."
The ruin in which they had set up their camp had been a fortress at one time. The stones were roughly squared off, and they had been set without mortar. Uncounted centuries of blowing dust and sand had worn the massive blocks smooth and had rounded the edges. Sparhawk crossed what appeared to have been a court to the tumbled wall on the south side of the fortress and looked down toward the road. A thick cloud bank had crept in during the night to obscure the sky. Sparhawk peered toward the road, silently cursing the darkness. Then he heard a faint rustling sound just on the other side of the broken wall.
"Don't get excited,"
Talon whispered.
"Where have you been?"
"Where else?"
The boy climbed over the rubble to join the big Pandian.
"Did you take Barret with you again?"
Sparhawk asked acidly.
"No. Barret's a little too noisy now that he's taken to wearing chainmail, and his integrity always seems to get in the way."
Sparhawk grunted.
"Well?" he asked.
"You're not going to believe this, Sparhawk."
"I might surprise you."
"Those are more of those Seer guy out there."
"Are you sure?"
"I didn't stop one to ask him, but they look exactly the same as those ones we ran across west of Sarsos did. They've got on those funny-looking helmets, the old-fashioned armor, and those silly short dresses they wear."
"I think they're called kilts."
"A dress is a dress, Sparhawk."
"Are they doing anything tactically significant?"
"You mean forming up for an attack?" "No, I think these are just scouts. They don't have their spears or shields with them, and they're doing a lot of crawling around on their bellies."
"Let's go talk with Vanyan and Sophrenia."
They crossed the rubble-littered courtyard of the ancient fortress.
"Our young thief's been disobeying orders again," Sparhawk told the others.
"No, I haven't," Talon disagreed. "You didn't order me not to go look at those people, so how can you accuse me of disobeying you?"
"I didn't order you not to, because I didn't know they were out there."
"That did sort of make things easier, I'll admit that."
"Our wandering boy here reports that the people creeping around down by the road are Seer guy." "Someone on the other side's been winnowing through the past again?"
Colton suggested.
"No,"
Flute said, raising her head slightly. The little girl had appeared to have been sleeping soundly in her sister's arms.
"The Seer guy out there are as alive as you are. They aren't from the past."
"That's impossible," Bevier objected. "The Seer guy are extinct."
"Really?"
the child goddess said.
"How astonishing that they didn't notice that. Trust me, gentlemen, I'm in a position to know. The Seer guy who are creeping up on you are contemporary."
"The Seer guy died out 10,000 years ago, Divine One,"
Itanya said firmly.
"Maybe you should run down the hill and let them know about it, Itanya," she told him. "Let me go, Sophrenia."
Sophrenia looked a little startled. Afriel kissed her sister tenderly, and then stepped a little way away.
"I have to leave you now.
The reasons are very complex, so you'll just have to trust me.
What about those seer guy? Calton demanded. We're not going to let you wander off in the dark while they're out there.
She smiled. Would someone please explain this to him? She asked them.
Are you going to leave us in danger like this?
Olaf demanded. Are you worried about your own safety, Olaf?
Of course not. But I thought I could shame you into staying until we dealt with them.
The seer guy aren't going to bother you, Olaf, she said patiently. They'll be going away almost immediately. She looked around at them. Then she sighed. I really have to leave now, she said regretfully. I'll rejoin you later. Then she wavered like a reflection in a pool and vanished. Ephriel, Sophronia cried, half reaching out.
That is truly uncanny, Itania muttered. Was she serious about the seer guy? He asked them. Is it at all possible that some of them actually survived their war with Asterix?
I wouldn't care to call her a liar, Olaf said. Particularly not around Sophronia. Our little mother here is very protective.
I've noticed that, Itania said. I wouldn't offend you or your goddess for the world, dear lady. But would you be at all upset if we made a few preparations? History is one of my specialties at the university, and this here guy have, I suppose, a fearsome reputation. I trust your little goddess implicitly, of course, but... He looked around apprehensively.
Sophronia? Sparhawk said.
Don't bother me. She seemed terribly shocked by Afriel's sudden departure.
Snap out of it, Sophronia. Afriel had to leave, but she'll be back later. I need an answer right now. Can I use Bellium to set up some kind of barrier that will hold the seer guy off until whatever it was that Afriel was talking about chases them away?
Yes, but you'd let our enemy know exactly where you are if you did that.
He already knows, Vanyan pointed out. I doubt that those seer guys stumbled across us by accident.
He has a point there, Bevier agreed.
Why bother with holding them off? Calton asked. Sparhawk can move us 10 leagues on down the road faster than we can blink. I'm not so attached to this place that I'll lose any sleep if I'm not around to watch the sun come up over it.
I've never done it at night, Sparhawk said dubiously.
He looked at Sophronia.
Would the fact that I can't see where I'm going have any effect at all?
How would I know? She sounded a little cross.
Please, Sophronia, he said. I've got a problem, and I need your help.
What in God's name is going on? Barrett exclaimed. He pointed to the north. Look at that.
Fog? Olaf said incredulously. Fog in the desert?
They stared at the strange phenomenon moving steadily toward them across the arid desert.
Lord Vanyan, Khalad said in a troubled voice. Does your map show any towns or settlements off to the north?
Vanyan shook his head. Nothing but open desert.
There are lights out there, though. You can see them reflecting off the fog. They're close to the ground, but you can definitely see them.
I've seen lights in the fog before, Bevier said. But never quite like that. That isn't torchlight.
You're right there, Olaf agreed.
End of side 4. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.